May it please the court. My name is Jeffrey Martin. I represent the appellant in this matter, Linda Thompson. First, I would be remiss if I did not express my appreciation to the court for allowing a rather lengthy continuance of this oral argument during my convalescence. So I'm most appreciative of that, and also grateful for my opposing counsel who did not oppose the same. Your Honors, this is a pretty straightforward case, and I'm sure this court has heard such a statement before with regard to other matters, but there was an abundant amount of evidence adduced at the two hearings below, the first hearing being a referee's hearing, the second hearing being the hearing before the UIAB, the Unemployment Insurance Appeal Board. I'd like to just call that board, if I may. And in both instances, there were decisions that that issued. In addition, we have transcripts from the various evidence that came into
Mr. Martin,
evidence. Yes, sir.
Are you? Does your appeal rely on existing law? Or are you asking us to declare a different rule of law in order for your client to prevail?
No, sir. I believe that the existing law more than supports my client's claim.
Okay. Well, help us, or help me, and tell us what rule of law your client relies on to warrant a reversal.
Thank you, Your Honor. The standard of review before this court is the substantial is whether there was substantial evidence to support the board's finding. In this case, the board found that there was just cause for my client's.
The question departure. Is, what does just cause mean?
Yes, sir. And just cause, or good cause, has been defined below. I don't believe that this court has issued a declaration on what just cause means, but there is a substantial agreement among the Superior Court that good cause exists when substantial deviation in working conditions from the original agreement of hire occurs to the detriment of the employee. Excuse me. In other words, an employee begins a particular job, and then through no fault of his or her, things change very radically. And I would submit that the facts in this case show a rather radical departure from the norm after Ms. Thompson began as an administrative assistant at the Wellness Center at the Howard High School.
Well, before we get into the weeds of the facts, let me make sure that I, like Justice Jacobs, have an understanding about what we're asked to do. First, it seems to me there's a question about whether sufficient facts supported the board's conclusion that there was just cause. And then the second issue is, did they, in reaching their conclusion, properly define good cause? Do these facts actually support the concept of good cause? Is that fair?
Yes, Your Honor.
And the Superior Court first found that apparently that facts didn't support, there wasn't substantial evidence of good cause, and then went on to find there was no good cause.
Your Honor, the lower court glossed over most of the significant facts that were adduced at the two hearings. There were so many facts that came across,
But let's assume for a moment that there is substantial evidence in the record to support the board's finding, its rationale for good cause, and that the real issue here is when the day is done, despite the appropriate deference to their fact-finding, do these facts under Delaware law, as it should define good cause, constitute good cause?
Yes, sir. I understand that, and my argument is in the affirmative that they do constitute good cause.
But good cause, the rule, the definition of good cause that your side relies on is that there was a substantial deviation from the original terms of employment caused solely by the employer through no fault of the employee. Is that the rule?
It is, Your Honor.
Okay, well, what were the original terms and what was the substantial deviation?
The substantial deviation was essentially the atmosphere of the working conditions, which were very conducive to my client's employment as an administrative assistant.
Okay, but in this case, there was a lot of backbiting going on.
Yes, sir.
Among other employees, your client, I guess, was subjected to that environment, but she was not in the line of fire. That is, none of that was addressed to her specifically.
That's correct, Your Honor. That is very correct.
Right. So what, you're saying that state of affairs constituted a substantial deviation from the original terms of employment. What are we talking about here when we're talking about, when you talk about original terms of employment?
Your Honor, if I may cite from the board's findings, I think that may be helpful to the court. In the last substantial paragraph of the decision, it's found on page 50 of the record, the board, through Ralph Durstein, Deputy Attorney General who wrote the decision, set forth the various facts or the factual findings that the board relied upon to find that indeed a substantial deviation had occurred. And they are essentially four. One is the board found that there was an unpleasant atmosphere involving behavior of fellow employees toward one another, as has been noted by Chief Justice Steele with the backbiting. It was also determined without any dispute that the situation, bless you, was ongoing and deteriorating. Thirdly, the employer failed to address the situation except by allowing other employees to transfer to other jobs and or facilities. And finally, the board found that the employer ignored claimant's many requests and left her with no real alternative. I think that those give a good flavor for the changes that occurred during her five-year tenure.
I understand that, but a change from what? That is, the rule that you're relying on presupposes some, contractually agreed upon arrangement that was violated. I don't mean by that necessarily contractual in the enforceable sense, but some understanding, ground rules.
That's correct, Your Honor. And indeed, there's no dispute this was employment at will in this particular situation. But the terms and conditions of her employment went from a pleasant place to work, wherein she was receiving very high reviews, to this situation described by one of her supervisors as chaos and causing all kinds of issues such as slamming doors, such as having verbal disputes in front of their clients. This was a wellness center at Howard High School, and apparently these differences spilled out into the high school, into the such that the principal was well aware of these disputes as well as the students.
What does the record show, if anything, about the effect of these changes on Ms. Thompson's ability to get her job done?
Your Honor, in addition to the substantial deviation standard that the lower courts have espoused, and we espouse in our argument, there's another aspect to it, and that is that in order to have this good cause or just cause, this must be viewed from a reasonable person standard rather than a case-specific standard. Hence, any type of medical issue that Ms. Thompson may have had was not relevant. Indeed, the board found that she did not submit medical evidence, but moreover, the medical issue was not part of the decision.
All right, well, let me ask the question this way then.
Yes, sir.
In these particular circumstances, would a reasonable person in Ms. Thompson's position have to suffer or be rendered unable to get her job done in order to have no alternative but to resign?
The board, Your Honor, was the finder of the fact, and this issue was squarely before the board, and the board determined that it was. This lady made efforts over a two-year period that included 38 attempts for removal to other facilities.
Well, let's back up for a minute. My first question that I asked you was, in this case, as a matter of fact, what impact, if any, did the deteriorating situation have on Ms. Thompson's ability to get her job done? Your response was, well, that's not relevant. What's relevant is the impact that it would have on a reasonable person. My next question was, well, what impact would that have on a reasonable person? That is, would a reasonable person in these exact circumstances have no alternative but to resign? Your response to that is, well, let's go back to the finding of the board. That's not, I'm not concerned about the finding of the board. I'm concerned about an issue of law.
Understand.
That is, what is your position here? And if you're saying that a reasonable person would have no, as a legal matter, would have no alternative, or at least could be found to have no alternative, what's the basis for that?
Again, Your Honor, that was the board's finding based upon all the facts and circumstances.
Yes, but the board's finding, which was a 2-1, wasn't it?
I'm not aware that it was 2-1.
Okay.
It may have very well been.
So we're being asked to...
The board, if I may, Your Honor, usually has 5 members.
I could be wrong.
And I was there.
It was a 2-1, I believe. But be that as it may, it was overturned. So we're being asked, as a matter of law, to reinstate it. And so that's, you know, the question I asked was couched as a matter of law, and I think the response
understood.
Ought to be as well.
Your Honor, you know, with regard to Ms. Thompson, and I've already said I don't think it's quite relevant, but she described the great amount of stress and emotional upheaval that this caused her to be able to not get her job
done. I can understand that she may be stressed, she may be uncomfortable, but she can still get her job done. That's one scenario. Another is that it causes her and would cause any reasonable person in her position to be so stressed that they couldn't get their work done. And when you add to that that she complained about it, brought it to the attention of the employer basically ignored her, you know, request for leave. You know, that might, or at least I assume you would argue that that certainly would justify resigning.
Yes.
But did that happen here?
Well, it happened here when Ms. Canatelli, the manager, told her outright at the very end of this long ordeal that there's nothing I can do to help you.
Right, but does the record show, and was there a finding one way or the other as to whether this sad state of affairs adversely affected this plaintiff's ability to get the job done? You know, that's, we keep on coming back to that, and I don't have an answer to the question.
Well, and Your Honor, that's because the board did not address that. They did not address the medical issue. They essentially adopted this reasonable person standard.
I'm not sure that's a medical issue.
Well, a medical issue in terms of, you know, my...
Did she testify?
Did she testify?
That,
yes, sir.
I was so upset I couldn't get anything done?
Words to that effect. Yes, she did. I was there during the board hearing, not during the referee's hearing.
Can you give us a cite to the record? And was there a finding on the board's part in that regard?
There was not a finding, Your Honor. In view of what the board understood the law to be, it did not need to occur. given that they felt objectively that she had every reason to leave her employment.
You're wanting to save your rebuttal time, and I appreciate that, but I would ask you to consider when you come back, having said that there's a consensus on Superior Court, when you come back, I'd like to get your view on what does something akin to exhausting his administrative remedies really mean.
Yes, sir. I'm happy to address that. Thank you.
May I please the court, Chief Justice Steele, Justice Holland, and Justice Jacobs. I'm Allison Britton, and I represent the appellee, Christiana Care, in this matter. I also have my colleague, David Williams, is with me as well. I wanted to start first with the issue that Your Honor just brought up with regards to the administrative remedies and how that ties into this issue. There's two main issues, and my colleague, Mr. Martin, didn't get to the administrative remedies issue. The first issue is good cause and whether there was good cause. The second issue is whether she failed to exhaust her administrative remedies. If the court finds that she did not have good cause to resign, the court does not even need to get to the issue of whether she failed or she failed to exhaust her administrative remedies. Because the first step would be to see if she has good cause. It doesn't make sense that if someone doesn't have good cause to resign from their position, that if they...
Which of these are you addressing now?
In the beginning, I just wanted to address the interplay between the two different...
We understand that. Okay. There's no good cause. We don't have to go any further. There is good cause. Then the question is, did she do what was necessary to get relief internally?
Exactly. Because I feel that in the board's decision, most of those things were kind of intertwined, and it didn't look like it was clear. So if the court doesn't need any further information about that, I won't go on. With regards to the first issue, good cause, under the standard of review, which has been discussed a little bit so far, there's two different standards of review. There's the substantial evidence standard, and the other one is whether there was a legal error, which means that the board did not apply the legal error properly to the facts of the case.
Do you agree with Mr. Martin's good cause definition that is the one that he's relying on?
Well, there have been different phrases used. That's one of them that's been used. But as I looked through the board's decision when Mr. Martin made his argument, I didn't see that articulated at all, so I'm not sure that that's the one.
What does your side contend is the rule that we that should govern this case?
Well, the one that I've seen most often used is good cause is such cause as would justify an employee to voluntarily leave the ranks of the employed and join the ranks of the unemployed. Don't know that that's extremely helpful, but there have been also some other phrases that the courts in this state have used, Superior Court primarily, that I have heard that it's a substantial deviation in working conditions. The courts have also said an employee's unhappiness does not amount to good cause. An employee does not have good cause to quit merely because there is an undesirable or an unsafe situation. The standard is a reasonable person standard, as Mr. Martin pointed out also. So I think that those are all factors that need to be considered for the legal standard of good cause.
All right, there's no statutory definition of good cause that we can use as a guideline or a guidepost. And this strikes me as scarily familiar in that our classic definition of good faith is the absence of bad faith. Is good cause the absence of bad cause, or is bad cause suggest no good cause? How do we put flesh on the bones of this concept of just cause or good cause to voluntarily leave employment?
I think that, one of the other things that have been said in the cases explaining good cause has to do with whether there is cruel and harsh punishment and those kinds of things. So if you look at that issue, in this case, The board said she didn't meet her burden to find that she was in a hostile work environment, which means there was no cruel and harsh punishment. The board made its finding on whether on the interactions and things that were going on in the atmosphere with regards to the other people in the office and how they treated each other. So what we're saying is that what does not even reach, doesn't even come close to the legal standard of good cause, which would be, you know, is she in an environment that's a cruel and harsh environment?
Well, I think the one thing that's not disputed is that there was a toxic atmosphere in that particular workplace. But, you know, nobody was taking an aerosol and directing it, pointing it to her. It just was all in the air, and she didn't like, the environment. If some of the toxicity were directed to her specifically, would that constitute good cause for her to resign?
In this case, if you look at it from a legal error or standard of review, no, I don't think that the
even if she was a target of the malicious gossip?
Well, I mean, looking at the facts of this case,
No, I'm saying looking at the facts of a different, of a hypothetical case.
Hypothetically, I guess there are facts out there, and there are some cases that we cited where an employee was treated terribly. Like, for example, and it did amount to good cause. In the Summers versus Woolworth case, the court found that there was good cause for the employee to resign. The employee in that case was not paid for his sick days. When he verified him with doctor's notes from the hospital, he had, like, I think 20 pages of doctor's notes, brought him in, and then the employer didn't pay him for any of them. And the employee said to him, he came in and said, I'm sick.
Well, that's really a pretty classic substantial deviation. That is that the employer says, I'm going to pay you, an honest wage for a day's work, and then doesn't do it. But do you have any hostile environment cases?
Well, this was more of a hostile environment case, because what happened was when the employee went to the employer and said, I need to take sick days, here's my evidence, the employer said, I'll tell you when you're sick enough to take off. And they thought that that was a cruel and harsh environment for the employee, and that the way that he directly had been treated was justification of good cause for him to resign.
Well, let's assume again for a moment that one of the things this panel has to do is to look at the Superior Court cases and see whether or not Mr. Martin's assertion is correct, that there is a consensus among Superior Court cases about what constitutes just or good cause, and then define for the first time at this level what should be a rule of thumb or a principled basis for factual findings that would constitute good or just cause. You've mentioned, and the argument has been mentioned, Mr. Martin mentioned substantial deviation from the terms of employment. You've mentioned hostility directed at an employee. I'm not sure what exhausting administrative remedies after finding some good basis factually for cause to leave voluntarily really means. Some of the language talks about good faith efforts to resolve them, obligation to inform the employer and all that. But if we go back fundamentally to just or good cause, what should be the definition of just or good cause?
In a situation where, are you asking in a situation that that this person is in where
I'm asking, I suppose, to be fair, two questions. First, is there a way of defining just or good cause that would serve as a principal basis regardless of the fact situation going forward? That's why I analogized earlier to good and bad faith. Very difficult without specific facts in each situation to even begin to think what's good and bad faith or here just cause for voluntarily leaving employment. But if you were to craft a classic definition of it, to be applied to all potential fact situations, what would it be?
What would cause a reasonable person to resign from their job?
And join the ranks of the unemployed. That's the definition we already have.
Well, let me just follow up on that and get you to clarify the record in your answer if you can. There appears to be an assertion that other people were not happy either, and they were able to get transferred. Is that correct?
There's an assertion by Mr. Martin, yes. That's correct.
Well, did that happen or not?
Well, there's not evidence in the record about those other employees other than Mrs. Thompson saying that other people transferred. There's no evidence as to what jobs they transferred for, that they were even...
Well, we'll just keep the ambiguous record as it is. For purposes of my question, it seems that she has a situation that she complained about, according to Mr. Martin, 38 times. She wasn't happy with her job. Other people weren't happy with the environment. And the other people got relief by being transferred. That type of relief wasn't offered to her, wasn't made available to her. So her only recourse was stay on the job or become unemployed. And she said, I've demonstrated my work conditions were completely unacceptable, and the option the employer gave to other people for a transfer wasn't offered to me, therefore I had to voluntarily leave or involuntarily leave, quit, become unemployed. Why isn't that enough for her to make her case?
Well, the reference to the 38 times that she did something, she testified that she applied for 38 transfers. Whether she did or not, you know, that's all the evidence that we have of that in the record. But applying for a transfer doesn't mean that you are exhausting your administrative remedies. She leaving the job, resigning, which if she's unhappy, she is more than, you know, she can do that. That's fine. But that doesn't amount to good cause for her to leave. That doesn't, she's not exhausting her administrative remedies because she's not trying to remedy the issue that she's having in her current employer.
Well, if the fact is she asked, you know, her superiors, whichever individuals that might be, to give her relief from this toxic environment, and she wasn't given that relief, but other people who were subjected to the same environment were allowed to transfer, why wouldn't that justify a reasonable person from resigning and joining the ranks of the unemployed?
Okay. I think I'm going to look, that issue really speaks to whether she exhausted her administrative remedies rather than whether there was good cause, but...
No, it assumes, and I'm asking you to assume that she did something that was akin to adjusting her, to exhausting her administrative remedies so that we can focus solely on good cause.
Okay. Well, if she, first of all, there really isn't evidence that the other people in the
you're saying it's not a fact.
No, because
suppose it was a fact.
Okay, suppose it is a fact. Transferring from a job, just because you're unhappy, does not amount to a good cause.
But if other people similarly situated are allowed to go someplace elsewhere within the organization and she's not, why wouldn't a reasonable person be justified in resigning?
But what is the... would question then, what is the evidence? Are those people more senior than her? Do they have more experience than her? Are they better performers than her? I mean, unless
assume,
that...
Assume they're similarly situated.
If they're similarly situated, I still don't think that other people being transferred would have anything to do with her.
Let me ask you to address the record here on this point. The board found that ordinarily the conduct of others would not provide a good cause for terminating employment. Then they find that the situation was ongoing and it deteriorated. It says the only way in which CCHS addressed the situation was by allowing employees other than Thompson to transfer. Is there any record evidence that there were 38 other transfers by way of example and they all related solely to the work environment? Or is there any evidence at all about why these transfers are caught?
No. And at one point in the record, and I can't pull out the page exactly at this time, she even said She made a comment about the other employees. They either left, resigned, or got transferred. She doesn't even know. There is no record in the there's no evidence in the record about these other employees, whether they were transferred, where they were transferred to, whether they resigned, or whether they just left. There's no evidence of that. And the board's conclusion that Your Honor just pointed out is not supported by substantial evidence. And it was an error of law for the board to make that conclusion.
But while we're focusing on this record, let me ask you the same question that I asked Mr. Martin, and that is, what, if anything, does the record show about whether or not the work environment adversely impacted Ms. Thompson's ability to get her job done?
I don't think that there's any evidence about that. At one point, she said she had good performance reviews and that she was a good employee. I don't recall anywhere in the record where there is any evidence of the fact that she her performance was subpar or anything like that.
And did the board make any finding in that regard?
No. The board didn't even mention the fact that there was anything about a substantial deviation from working conditions, and I don't recall a finding with regards to whether she – I don't think that they found at all on that issue whether she could or could not perform her job. I think that the board's decision is based solely on the fact that she there was a work environment that was unpleasant. And Your Honor's question about what should be the standard for good cause, it's what a reasonable person would be able to stand. Would it be cruel and harsh punishment? No. And if there's cruel and harsh punishment, that would be good cause. Someone being unhappy, I would say, is not good cause. An undesirable situation is not good cause. I think it's going to, you know.
Well, that's why I asked what the record supports with regard to other individuals who moved on. You've already told us they might have moved on for other reasons, but if we have a history of people moving on because they couldn't tolerate this work environment, wouldn't that be some objective evidence of what reasonable people do?
If there were evidence in this case of other employees, I guess that would be a consideration.
Well, let's take Justice Holland's question and craft it to fit potential facts in this case without you being asked to concede that the facts are in the record. If the evidence actually showed that 38 co-employees transferred on the basis that the work environment at the Wellness Center was so hostile to their ability to get the job done, they applied for it and got a transfer. However, she repeatedly applied for a transfer as her form of something akin to an administrative remedy because she believed that it was hurting her work environment, making it impossible for her to perform up to her standard. And the evidence actually supported 38 people, but not her, got a transfer. Wouldn't you find that fitting very neatly into your concept of hostility directed to her? But the facts are there or are not there to support that?
So if in the hypothetical situation, if there were evidence that the other employees were able to transfer, there was sufficient evidence of that, I think that would be a consideration.
Well, by that I'm going to interpret you would mean that would be good cause for leaving, resigning voluntarily, and joining the ranks of the unemployed, if that were factually substantiated.
Yes, with the caveat that she would need to, I don't think that applying for a transfer is akin to failing or exhausting administrative remedies.
Well, if the facts here show that she went to Ms. Cantinelli, or however her name is appropriately pronounced, as her supervisor, and the answer that Mr. Martin gave us is reflected in the record, that her administrative supervisor said, I can't do anything about it. Is that not akin to exhausting your administrative remedies?
No. With regards to the she went to Mrs. Conatelli to say to her, I'm unhappy. She went to her 2 days before she resigned and told her that she was not happy. Ms. Conatelli was looking into the issue at that point and had contacted Employees Relations, was getting advice on how to address the situation that was going on with Mrs. Thompson in her current environment. When at that point, she only gave her 2 days to work it out. She said to Mrs. Conatelli, said, "What can I do for you?" And she said, "I want a transfer." And Mrs. Conatelli said, "I can't do that for you." That's not seeking or she failed there to seek administrative remedies because she wasn't seeking to address the situation that she was currently in. All she wanted to do was transfer. And the board even said in its decision, her main focus, her main agenda in this whole thing was transferring. That's not akin to administrating.
Let's focus for a minute on this other issue, which is akin to exhausting administrative remedies. That phrase puzzles me and maybe some others. I gather we shouldn't regard that in any literal sense because we're not talking here about a governmental administrative agency. It may possibly be a useful analogy if we had a giant corporation that had a big bureaucracy, with all sorts of layers of authority and people, and layers of reporting. But suppose we don't. That is, suppose we have a small, loose organization, that doesn't have all of that bureaucracy built into it. What type of exhaustion are we really talking about? That is, how do we reformulate that so that it makes sense, in a small company or one that isn't bureaucratized?
The employee would need to seek to address the issues in their current situation by going to the appropriate person in human resources, or if there's a policy in place that they could go to their manager.
So it's basically to utilize whatever avenues of redress are available in that organization.
For their current situation, not transferring.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Martin, I know you don't have much time, but this
4 minutes.
This should be pretty quick. We know she asked for a transfer 2 days before she quit. Prior to that, how many times had she asked for a transfer?
38, Your Honor. It's undisputed in the record.
But she was talking to the same person?
2 days before she resigned, she sent in her letter of resignation. But she talked to Ms. Canatelli 6 months before that, and each time during their monthly meetings about the situation. This was not something new on January 29th, 2008. As to the administration, or as to the exhaustion of remedies, Your Honor had asked, Judge Brady in the Abbasi case used that language akin to exhausting administrative remedies. I submit that it's going to be different in each situation. That phrase has a very different context if you're talking about filing a discrimination claim.
Well, it's basically a term of art that's used in administrative law. And administrative law, deals with government agencies.
Yes, sir. That's correct. And I am actually in agreement that the employee need do something rather than just leave. In this particular case, Ms. Thompson went through 4 levels of management asking about or complaining about this situation. She also went to a lady by the name of Eklund, who was in Human Resources. While my opponent says she never contacted Human Resources, she certainly did. And Ms. Eklund told her that you don't have to go through HR. You have that route of going through your management, and that's what she did. And so I think that is akin to exhausting administrative remedies under the circumstances.
Anything further?
No, sir.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank
counsel.
You.
We'll take the case under advisement and recess.
Yes, sir.